This week on the Syneos Health Podcast, we'll be returning to the Health Trends 10, this time as the clinical side of the business. I'm Jeff Stewart from Syneos Health Consulting. I'll be rejoined by Leah Householder, who's the author of the Health Trends 10 2019 report. Also with Leah will be Nick Kenny. Nick Kenny is our Chief Scientific Officer here at Syneos Health. Health Trends 10 Clinical 2019, next on the Syneos Health Podcast. Nick Kenny, Leah Householder, welcome back to the Syneos Health Podcast.
Thanks, Jeff.
Thank you, Jeff.
I should say welcome to the Syneos Health Podcast for you, Nick. You haven't joined us before. Can you tell us who you are?
Yeah, certainly. So my name is Nick Kenny. I'm the Chief Scientific Officer at Syneos Health, and I've been with the company since the beginning of 2006. I've spent a considerable amount of time growing and running the oncology team prior to becoming CSO.
And you and I worked together in a previous firm that's since been acquired by Syneos Health, and that's how we got to Syneos Health, I think, years ago, at least in the first place. Nice to reconnect with you. Today, we're talking about the Health Trends 10 2019. But on the clinical side, last time we talked about the commercial side of the business. This time, we're talking about the clinical side of the business. We'll just start there. What do we see, Leah and Nick, that's happening in 2019 that's different from before?
So I think there's a tremendous amount of really interesting information in the trends report, Jeff. And a couple of things that shine out for me, if I think about just the clinical aspect. So the first is probably the trials everywhere aspect. I'll come on to that. And maybe second would be how evidence can support trials in unique ways that we couldn't do in the past, that I think we'd really need to focus on exploiting. But if I think about the trials everywhere trend, you know, there's a pretty startling chart in this report that shows what looks like an exponential increase in clinical trials. And I think that's acutely felt in areas like oncology and rare diseases. And so if I was to characterize that, you know, in some ways, what we're looking at in those spaces is an old analogy. It was the best of times. It was the worst of times. Because the best of times is that there are so many innovative new medicines and combination therapies that are driving improved outcomes for patients. And for that, we need to look no further than some of the spectacular durable responses we've seen with CAR T cells. We can look at the curative intent and great responses we're seeing in gene therapies for monogenic diseases, like some of the hemophilias. You know, if you look at immunotherapy combination approaches, I mean, melanoma is getting turned on its head. What used to be a sort of an instant diagnosis with a very dismal prognosis for just months of life is now people are on maintenance therapy for their melanoma with some drugs. So that's all really good. That's the best of times. The worst of times is who on earth is going to do all of these trials? Because if you look in oncology, the administrative burden for investigators to actually participate in trials is actually getting harder, not less. And so at a time when we're trying to drive more trials out into the community and access more patients who currently don't get a chance to get into clinical trials that they would qualify for, the technology side of it is driving the trials more back into big academic medical centers. And, you know, for example, in oncology, you still see that less than 5% of patients are available to participate in trials, whether that's due to geographic issues, their knowledge about trials, other access issues and ethnicity and stuff. So you've got this sort of two-way tension that there's the pull to take the cool science into big institutions, but the real need is to get broader bases of patients that are available for trials, partly for better health management, but partly to be able to accomplish all this trial work that needs to get done. And so I think this trials everywhere idea that brings together a variety of initiatives, to me, is just intriguing, so that we can get the right patient to the right trial, whether that's using data when we can scrub through electronic health records from federated approaches across a variety of study sites and actually match out patients to available trials. There's similar things going on in Europe, for example, with European reference networks for rare diseases. But then I think some of the initiatives that we allude to in the trials everywhere are this idea of parachuting in administrative support to deal with all the regulatory and just paperwork issues of a trial and allow local physicians to deal with the care and management of their patients in a clinical trial setting. I mean, I think that to me is incredibly interesting and important. And the more we can focus on driving these intriguing new trials with their technology out into the community and better accessing patients, the more of these trials we'll be able to do in a timely fashion. But if we don't pay attention to that, then I have no idea how we're going to do these thousands of trials that are just stacking up all the time.
Those are great points, Nick. And there are a couple of things I would just like to put a little bit of a point on. If you think about that history that we have with barriers to increased clinical trial participation. You're looking at things like geography, transportation, awareness, trust. And the model that you're talking about is a new trial footprint. So instead of hoping that a patient happens to be physically or geographically close to a clinical trial site, instead, that electronic health record data that you're talking about allows us to identify patients wherever they already happen to be seeing a doctor. Then teams reach out to that practice, offer the clinical trial opportunity, the doctor you already trust brings that to you as a patient, and then this is the footprint part. The trial is actually executed by a centralized investigator team. So they have the infrastructure, the research system, the support. And the patient just keeps going to the practice they know and trust without putting any significant additional administrative burden on that practice. It's a completely different approach that suddenly in the U.S. gives us access to 97% of patients instead of those that just happen to be in the same geography. The other item I wanted to mention is that you were talking about the incredible times that we live in, and I remember listening to an investigator talk just a few years ago about the massive shifts that we're seeing. And he said, we are in the position for the first time of bending the arc of major disease, and the first to fall to the axe of science will be cancer. And that statement has just stuck with me because the incredible times we work in require really different ways of engaging patients and engaging sites to be able to be successful as so many innovative new drugs come down the pipeline and require significant populations of both doctors and patients to be able to truly investigate their efficacy and safety.
Yeah, I think those are excellent points. I want to pick out one thread you've mentioned there, and I think it's that physician-to-patient trust. You know, I think we've all seen interviews with patients about why don't you participate in a trial, and even sometimes people in the oncology setting may not be willing to make a road trip to get therapy, even when they've exhausted all current options. They might rather elect to stay home and spend quality time with their family because the logistics of perhaps transiting to a hospital, even perhaps two or three hours away, just seem unmanageable to them. So you're absolutely right. Having that local trust and continuity of therapy with a physician that you already know is very powerful.
Some of our participants in the trends report this year actually made another prediction. Nick, I'd love to hear what you think about it. They said that in the years ahead, we may be looking at third place options for patients to be able to participate in the clinical trial. And that third place is connected to Starbucks. Starbucks always talks about how you have home and work, and then you have a third place, which is Starbucks. And the third place is potentially pharmacies. As the front of the store sales start to fall in pharmacies, they're looking for new ways to bring true healthcare into the pharmacy and potentially administering clinical trials, especially with this back-end team, could be a way that they continue to grow their impact in the community. What do you think about that? Can you imagine a world where you did some of your clinical trial check-ins, tests, documentation in your local pharmacy?
Yeah, I mean, that's a fascinating idea, right? Because if you look, and certainly there are grades of clinical trials, right? I think some of the more complex oncology trials would not lend themselves to that. People need to be hospitalized and all those things. But for the other end of the spectrum, when you're doing investigations that involve patients with diabetes or some cardiovascular issues that are much more sort of chronic, then absolutely, if you think about a lot of the nuts and bolts of many trials that we do, simply involve a patient showing up to get a blood draw that goes off to a central lab and then ends up getting into the database, right? They don't need to go to a hospital for that. So yeah, if anything you can do to make it easier for the patient and the family to get all of that routine work done and only need to show up at the hospital for true complicated interventions and final observations, has got to make this much more palatable for everybody involved. And I think from a patient perspective, if you now ask somebody to sign up for some sort of investigational therapy and say, oh, and by the way, 9 of the 10 things you'll have to do in this trial, you can do it in a local setting, as you pointed out, perhaps in a pharmacy. It's a fascinating concept.
What does all of this mean for pharma companies? I see it's better for patients. It's better for the physicians who have never been involved in clinical trials that can now be involved. It might be better for your local CVS or Walgreens or MinuteClinic. What does it mean for pharma companies, though?
The advantage for manufacturers is certainly speed and scale. When you're looking at having 7,000 different drugs in the pipeline right now, the competition for sites and the need to be able to quickly get those trials launched and into market is incredible. The amount of pressure on these manufacturers is so significant right now. So So being able to think more innovatively about what sites you do the trial at, what kind of physicians do you engage, how do you reach patients, it's a massive differentiator in their ability to effectively bring a drug to market. So that's the advantage side. The challenge side is that you really do have to think and work differently. Being able to understand the new technologies, the new networks, the new possibilities and how to connect with people, it's a massive learning curve. And when we look at the trends coming into 2019, it's a very steep slope that our clients and partners are trying to climb. And as we start to build these proofs of concepts and these options to use these different networks and different approaches, hopefully what we're doing is creating a clearer path to make that possible.
I think you're right. I think there's sort of two parts to it, right? The broadening of access to a much larger patient population has got to be in everybody's best interest. Because if you look at the stats in any decent report, whether it's from the Tufts Center for Drug Development or anywhere else, generally the number one reason cited for delays in drug development is enrollment was behind what we needed to do or behind predictions, or we couldn't find the patients in a timely fashion. And that comes full circle to the fact that, you know, less than 5% of patients who could participate actually do. So by broadening that accessibility to patients, inherently your speed has to increase. So that's the really cool part. The challenge, I think, and this is what you've just alluded to, is just to have some disruptive thinking about, all right, how can we use remote data access through things like wearables and get valid data out of that into our database and trust that information? How can we engage with regulators to say that all of these things are going to be okay? We can show you adequate and sufficient control over patient safety, over ethical concerns, and over quality of data that the data will collect in these unusual settings, whether it's from a wearable or in a pharmacy setting or wherever else that might be. That data is valid. And I think where we need to think disruptively about that is, as an industry, we're so used to filling out all the paperwork that says, we're going to work with John Smith at Hospital X, and here's all of the documentation that goes with that, and only John Smith at Hospital X can touch all of the patients and all of the data that comes out of that trial.
Mm-hmm.
So a more distributed approach to where that data comes from, I think, requires close dialogue with the regulatory authorities to float the idea, say, this is why we think it's valid. Here's how we'll actually validate that data. Here's how we'll validate that we've taken care of concerns around patient safety and ethics. And then to do real studies with that to compare and show that, in fact, this is a valid approach. And we did just as well as doing it the old-fashioned way, to put it frankly. So there are two parts to it, right? We all have to benefit from the better access to patients. Patients clearly will, because they're clearly underserved. The companies will serve better because they'll be able to either move more drugs through or kill drugs that are ineffective sooner. And we don't have to wait around and unnecessarily expose other patients to those drugs. And then I think the rest of it all just falls from there. But unless we think creatively with regulators, it's going to be a struggle.
Not just regulators too, but also the investigative sites. I was recently at the CNS Summit and spent time with a number of people who lead clinical sites, and I heard so much desire for them to be able to do more innovative digital arms of trials, try to share data in different ways, try to empower patients in different ways. So there's actually a lot of desire on both sides of manufacturers wanting to be able to take new approaches, their site partners being really interested in pushing the entire experience forward. So there are moments that we'll see in 2019 and beyond where we're able to co-create those changes, not only with those two parties, but also patient advocates as well, and find the moments or the places where we can improve the experience for everyone involved.
I thought it interesting that we don't just use established clinical trial sites because that's where the patients are, but because the clinical trial managers, the clinical trial principal investigators, they're experienced. They've done this before. How does this change when we move to what almost seems like ride sharing for clinical trials, where we're taking a local physician that's never been in a clinical trial before, never managed one before? How do we manage that?
I think it's a great point that you bring up, because we're so used to dealing with a group of physicians that are completely au fait with GCP. They understand all the paperwork. They know what they're getting into. And I think particularly if you look in sort of early drug development spaces where it might be the first time a drug's gone into a patient, they're attuned to what that means in terms of managing safety and understanding the science and what to look out for when that drug goes into a patient for the first time. So I don't think you'd want to take those kinds of trials out into a community setting. But once you've gathered that basic comfort, if you like, with how a drug is going to behave in a human population, then certainly what you can get into phase twos and threes and beyond, going out into the community setting, we have to do it, right? It's feasible at every level. You know, I don't mean to make light of it, but I think really it's no more, no less than simple education. By taking part in this trial, what are you signing up to do? What does that mean in terms of what the FDA expects of you? What does it mean in terms of what we expect you to do in terms of capturing information and data? What do we pull out of your system that you already have, as opposed to what new data you do need to collect? What sort of timing are we looking at to do this? That, to me, is all trainable. I think the piece that intrigues me about this is that what I hope it would mean is, one, that we distribute the trials more broadly, that you can do that in a setting where it's relatively safe because you've got a bit more information about the drug. And so that cohort, if you like, of experienced investigators at sort of big academic medical centers that we're often used to working with, it turns them loose, if you like, to deal with the really thorny trials, if you like, the ones that are first inpatient, maybe complex things like gene therapies and CAR T cells, and perhaps classes of drugs that we already understand much better, are much better placed out in the community. So you can have that natural sort of subspecialization, perhaps, that allows you to get more bandwidth out of everybody. That's maybe an awkward way of putting it, but I think you understand what I mean.
I do. And one of the other advantages that just comes to mind as we talk through this, if we're going to a trials everywhere sort of approach, is that early adopters are often clinical trials. Your clinical trial sites are early adoption sites for when you hit the market. So if we move to a trials everywhere approach, two things happen. One, we get a more accelerated launch, potentially, because more physicians have already seen the drug in trials and become more knowledgeable and excited about it. And second, and this is kind of an interesting way to look at that, trials, of course, also draw away from commercial success of other products. And so if we're thinking about all the patients being tied up in clinical trials in major centers we always go to, and those are also the same places we tend to launch and put our sales force towards, that's very different if we've now spread out the clinical trial to places that might not have been the first, second, or third places we go, not the top decile physicians. Now we're putting the clinical trials in sites that maybe would have been late adopters. So at the same time that we're seeding the market, essentially, by informing them on the clinical trial side, the same places that now are being used for clinical trials do not draw away from the commercial success of new launches in the same way that currently we've done these projects for, as you mentioned earlier, Nick, on melanoma and oncology, and they're great drugs. But we also know that the trials that are ongoing for melanoma drugs draw away from the commercial success of drugs that are on the market. And that's less of a problem if we spread it out.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I think it helps you with a couple of wins, if you like. One is that commercial launch angle that, as you correctly point out, you have a much broader base of physicians and practices that already have comfort and experience with a drug. They're not on a steep learning curve, particularly with things that may have complex side effects that you have to know how to manage very promptly. So that, to me, is a win. I think from a patient perspective, it's also a win because nobody wants late adopters for a great therapy, right? You don't want people being cautious if something really can have an immediate impact on somebody's health. You want them all to adopt quickly. But as you pointed out correctly, I think that the way that we currently run trials actually create an unwanted barrier, and you have to spend an awful lot of time then going out into those community settings to explain the profile of the drug and get everybody comfortable. So yeah, the more that you do in that setting to begin with in a trial setting, you've preceded the field, you're right.
So trials everywhere, that's one trend that we see as being extremely important for 2019. What else? What's next?
One trend I'm really interested in for 2019, we're calling the personal label. And the idea behind it is what we're researching for. So label and label extension strategy are starting to shift from a goal of creating a broader and broader set of indications to a focus on getting to a very specific one. Said a different way, first, pharmaceutical innovators are increasingly looking to identify indications that let them get the treatment to the right patient and only the right patient. And that specificity ultimately lets them become the preferred approved treatment for a subsegment across a multi-payer environment. What's interesting, I think, is that this hyper-targeting in what would have normally been mass drugs are allowing us to be able to focus on only a segment of patients where we'll have the biggest impact. What pharmaceutical companies want is 100% of the patients in a particular population, and that leads to new questions like, where can the drug make the most meaningful difference? instead of where can the treatment make any kind of impact. Now, if you think about the clinical trial space, the shift is happening in part because of that crowding that we were talking about, but also because research methodologies are becoming much more sophisticated. These more personalized labels are enabled by testing against what I would call like now really well-known levers of scientific discovery, like biomarkers or comorbidities. But increasingly, some of the things Nick was talking about, like behavior that can be tracked with diaries or wearables and demographic subsegments. So as you start to think about those more personalized drugs, the ones that really are targeted to a specific patient group, you have to be able to find those patients. It can create an incredibly difficult challenge for innovators to try to determine how do you develop a drug for 5,000, for 10,000 people? How do you effectively test it, price it, find the patients who would need it? And increasingly, as we go into 2019, no surprise, data is going to be the answer to that question. Healthcare manufacturers on the clinical side and the commercial side are thinking about patient journey maps that offer more nuanced understandings of real-life experience because they leverage things like claim codes and search data. But particularly for our clinical teams, they're able to use electronic healthcare data to pre-size potential clinical trial populations. So they're using that kind of de-identified clinical and genomic data to estimate the number of patients who would match the specific criteria that they're thinking about and get to an aggregated picture that identifies whether or not we're going to have enough eligible patients to be able to run that trial and also which sites they're most likely to be at. So we're actually laser targeting that cohort before the trial is even launched.
I think that last point you made really resonates for me, that sort of speaks, I think, to the whole approach with evidence, right? Evidence is a word I could apply broadly across what we need to focus on. But you're going out and using real data to find evidence that what you're about to do is both feasible in general, feasible in a particular setting, and will, if the drug acts as you plan, have a positive outcome in a well-defined subset of patients. I think you're right, Lee, that, you know, historically, if you think about how we perhaps develop things like oncology drugs, there was a shotgun, right? We knew we had a chemotherapeutic. If you put enough patients into the trial, you would somehow figure out that there was a cohort of those patients that, for whatever reason, responded well. And we've all seen, unfortunately, survival curves in many, many trials where they slope off at different rates. Initiatives like the NCI Exceptional Responder Program have been trying to fish through that data and figure out why did people respond and not.
NCI, National Cancer Institute.
Yeah, correct. So that initiative from the National Cancer Institute, I think, is looking backwards into sort of older chemotherapeutic data and try to figure out why did we have exceptional responders? How could we have picked those guys out and only targeted them with this particular drug so that everybody else could try a different therapy, right? Well, now, if you look at the way that we do this, to your point with scrubbing through real-world data and with targeted therapies or things that are going after monogenic diseases, you have that much more, what was the word you used, hyper approach to diseases where you're just picking out these small subsets that, based upon your science, predict a much better outcome. So you have a much bigger opportunity to do a quick pass-fail if the class of drug doesn't work. You also have a better opportunity to not unnecessarily expose patients to a drug that they really aren't likely to respond to. We don't have to do that anymore. And so you're right. You can pretty quickly size out what should your trial look like, what should the response criteria look like, what should the differential look like, and where are those patients? So the evidence all around that, all the way from science to digging through EHRs to find the patients, is much more powerful now than certainly when I began doing this a couple of dozen years ago.
Is there a risk that we run, and I think we talked about this on a previous episode from medical affairs and market access, the risk that we see is that on the payer side, as soon as you hand them clinical trial criteria that are narrow, that's a weapon that they can use, and they can just exclude patients from the clinical trial basis. Doesn't matter what the indication says. If they can reach into the clinical trial inclusion-exclusion criteria and they can use that, they will.
That has an impact on two sides of the equation. One is you could say that it let payers limit the population that would be covered, but you could also say that it lets payers focus on the population to be covered. So we're seeing a number of manufacturers go after pragmatic clinical trials after launch because they did not get preferred status with payers. What they're trying to do is prove which subsegment of patients that they're the most effective in so that they can get preferred status within that subsegment So it really depends on what you're trying to develop evidence for and what your patient climate looks like, whether or not that's a positive or negative, that the payers can use that inclusion-exclusion criteria as an element of preference or formulary.
Well, that makes sense, Leah. And there's also the added benefit. We see this with client after client as they're going to do their value proposition decks, their presentations that they're making to payers. The very first thing that they have to do, if it's an unusual corner case or indication, is to size the box. Tell them how many patients in their plan they're actually going to have to pay for. Because if they don't know that, they assume the number is very high. And we saw this with, I think it was the PCSK9 inhibitors, where the estimate was $100 billion market or something like that, that came out from CVS, if I'm remembering correctly. It might have been Express Scripts, by the way. But because the box wasn't sized for them, at least proactively in those cases, they assumed the box was very, very large. And this, as we come back and have, we're narrowing the box. We're saying it's only for these patients. That does provide an easier case, as you suggest, Leah, to make preferential access for these drugs.
I love that phrase, size the box. And I think 2019 is the moment to pick your box. And we're just going to see more and more of that with our innovator clients.
Tiny, tiny boxes.
I agree with you, Leah. I think it's an opportunity, right? Because if you have real-world data you can go out and pull that will help you size that box in advance and go have those discussions with payers, then you're not doing it on the back end, right? You're not going to take the hit because nobody knows what the size of the box is and they assume it's really big and they try to dilute your price and you can't recover your costs and the drug doesn't succeed and all those things. So I think, again, it goes back to the idea of using the evidence that we can collect and have that early dialogue, whether it's with payers or regulators when you're trying to get a drug. We have so much more powerful data that we can do that with now as opposed to in previous iterations that we just couldn't do that.
So we've got two of the trends. We don't have time to get to all 10 trends or even the sub-trends within the trend, so look for the report. We have time, I think, for one more. What's one more thing we see in the clinical side of the business 2019 as a health trend 10?
Well, Nick, I know neither you or I are an absolute expert on China, but I feel like we can't end this interview without talking about the region that has been massively disrupted coming into 2019. What do you think about the changing regulatory environment in China and what it means for our partners in pharma?
It's a great point. You know, if I reflect back to even maybe less than 10 years ago when I first had the opportunity to look at clinical trials in China, it was a treasure trove that you couldn't get to, let's put it that way. So it used to take us anywhere from 12 to 15 months to get through all the regulatory paperwork to get a trial up and running. And there were all kinds of other obstacles about the kind of data that you could collect. There were challenges that many of the hospitals were not trained on GCP. You had to go in and do that, and so on and so forth. So it was a huge potential reservoir of patients that would benefit from these drugs that we could do the trials in. But there were so many roadblocks along the way to get there that particularly in innovative therapies like in oncology where you were trying to do rapid development, nobody could afford to wait around for those 12 to 15 months just to get the trial off the ground and then deal with all the other stuff. If you fast forward to today, there are multiple things to me that are fascinating about what's changed in China. So the first is they have completely upended their regulatory process to say, all right, enough of that old-fashioned stuff. We're going to become much more like FDA and EMA. We're going to have short, dedicated timeframes. We'll be there for consultation. We're going to accelerate timelines, particularly around innovative therapies in oncology. Come and do your trials here. So that was huge. I think the broadening of the skill sets in hospitals around GCP has just gone on at an exponential pace. I think the fact that they're now willing to take drugs in country that were developed outside without too much burden of China-only data, they're recognizing that these things are valid in their own right, bring those into their formularies. If you look at the investment community that drives dollars within China into their own biotech, that's been just simply an explosion. And we've gone from having a small handful of innovative biotechs there to a massive number that have frankly thrown huge amounts of money and labor at problems in many ways are outstripping what's going on in the rest of the world if you look at the pace of change. But not only that, I think there's been massive investment coming out of China into ex-China biotechs, particularly in the U.S. So that the investment and the innovation coming out of China now is just unrecognizable from when I first began. And so what that does, I think it creates both challenges and opportunities. So for a lot of our customers, you know, the challenge is they have much more competition from these very aggressive, very innovative companies coming out of China. For their trials, it means that because of the scale of the patient populations there, you know, I mean, some hospitals will see more patients in a year than perhaps a dozen hospitals in the U.S. might see collectively with that much volume. So you can accomplish your trial goals so much faster in a much tighter setting than you might do in the rest of the world, particularly if we look at how saturated the trial environment is in Western Europe and North America. So you're absolutely right. I mean, it's just an enormous sea change. And it's one of those sea changes that if you're not an early adopter, if you're not on board with it, and if you're not prepared to really innovate and buckle down to get with it, you're going to get left behind.
What we're really seeing or learning about in China is what an environment looks like when real-world evidence becomes a critical part of ongoing commercialization. China, Japan, and others are increasingly accepting out-of-geography evidence to be able to approve and launch drugs in region, but they're expecting to have a continual stream of ongoing real-world data and evidence about how it's affecting their populations and their patients. And that's a shift that's starting in China and Japan, but that we are going to increasingly see in Europe and the U.S., that is going to shift the dynamic of what global commercialization teams look like. Because when your responsibility becomes being able to deliver an ongoing stream of local and regional evidence, that single global structure doesn't work anymore. Everything has to get much more on the ground, much more local to the people that we want to connect with. And I think that's a really exciting part of 2019 and going into this next era of evidence.
Well, I think we'll just leave it there. Nick Kenny, Leah Householder, thank you for being on the Syneos Health Podcast.
Thanks, Jeff.
Thank you, Jeff.
If you'd like a copy of the Health Trends 10 2019 report, you can download it from a link in our show notes. That's all for today's episode of the Syneos Health Podcast. I'm your host, Jeff Stewart, from Syneos Health Consulting. If you have comments, suggestions, questions, or if you just want to talk to a particular challenge that you have at your life sciences company, you may email me at podcast@syneoshealth.com. That's syneoshealth.com. We're consultants. That's what we do.